This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to this special CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Howie Lee, Global Head of Index and ETFs, Nick Stansbury, Head of Climate Solutions, and Raza Aga, Head of Emerging Market Credit Strategy. Well, we're devoting today's session to tackling some of the questions we've received from our clients about the conflict in Ukraine, which, in addition to creating a vast humanitarian crisis, is continuing to reshape the investment landscape. So with no further ado, Sonia, let's kick off with two questions. First, of all the market developments since the Russian invasion, which are at the forefront of your thinking? And second, how much more challenging has the balancing act faced by central bankers become?
Yes, thank you, Max, and thank you all for joining us today. And as we've put in the title, I think there's a few clues already in what we have seen as the key ingredients into the current market setup. And I think, as you've called out, Max, it obviously is not discounting the immense humanitarian tragedy that is unfolding, because markets will look at the facts. So what are we seeing? As we said from the beginning, we always knew that Russia is not big in a GDP context and is probably equivalent to the size of Spain, but Russia has an outsized impact on global commodities market. So if you look at what's currently unfolding, it's clearly a massive jump in a large number of commodity prices, and Nick will clearly go more into detail of what this means. But if I stick to the high level, then this is translating into even more exacerbated inflationary pressures, and this obviously leads to a very uncomfortable mix of even higher inflation. And when I say even higher, then what I'm referring to is obviously the already very much pandemic-induced higher inflationary levels that we brought into 2022 that have now reached even higher levels based on the current crisis. Why is that so uncomfortable? Because we're not only facing high inflation, but we're already now seeing the potential negative growth implication that will follow the energy crisis, particularly here in Europe. And that means if you look at it from a central bank perspective, you have the very uncomfortable balancing of very high inflation with potentially slowing growth. And you need to adjust your policy response to that conundrum and to that setup. We have heard from the Fed that March is pretty much in play and that we will see the first rate hike, because it's very clear that, as we've said in the past, central banks clearly have to make sure that inflation expectations are not becoming unanchored. And as we know, energy prices are clearly a big, big driver of inflationary pressures, but they have broadened over the past couple of months. And as such, inflationary pressures, including wage inflation and other areas, clearly are becoming entrenched, and central banks will have to do something to react to it. From a growth impact, the direct impact is moderate, as we said, but it's the indirect impact, it's the transmission mechanism of higher energy crisis and prices and commodity prices that will find its way into the growth outlook. Europe in particular, because we know the dependency of Europe and on Russian gas in particular is such that there is not an easy solution to come out of it. So that, I think, in a nutshell, is what markets have been grappling with. The increased uncertainty around the potential geopolitical outcome obviously has led to higher volatility, and we have seen the relatively expected reaction function. So we have safe haven assets that have benefited. We have seen huge volatility and movements in equity markets, and clearly spread widening. But I know Raza will take a look at this as well. So I think the big question from here clearly is in the context of market developments, where from here, particularly from a growth angle, because from an equity market standpoint, the situation actually has been actually relatively moderate. But obviously, with a potentially changed growth outlook, we might have to reconsider the attractiveness of some of the asset classes.
Thank you for that overview, Sonia. This is a great point to bring Nick into the conversation. Nick, as Sonia mentioned, inflation, of course, we've seen some very large moves in commodity markets. How has the conflict actually affected supply and demand dynamics?
So it's probably worth stepping back a minute and remembering that we came into this crisis in an environment of already significantly elevated commodity prices. The broad commodities complex was at high levels for a range of reasons, running from stresses as a result of the pandemic, underinvestment, and the very early stages of the emergence of some of the commodity pricing pressure that we think is going to result from the energy transition. So we started this in an environment of high commodity prices. And then we've had to grapple with the dual reality that both Ukraine and Russia, within the zones of their specific relevant commodities, are extremely outsized important markets. For energy commodities, well understood, Russia is the third largest exporter of oil into global markets and responsible for something like a third of European natural gas supplies. Although obviously in Central Europe and some of the Southern European countries, much more than a third accounts for maybe 70 or even 80%. And so unsurprisingly, energy markets, they were already at high levels. We've seen oil prices climb by 20, 25%. We've seen gas prices have risen by about two thirds. European gas prices are now trading at an implied oil price of something like $250 a barrel. But we've seen moves in other markets too. Ukraine, historically a really, really important supplier of soft commodities. We've seen the wheat price go up by around 50%. Even more worryingly, when we think about the energy transition implications, Russia is a supplier of enormous importance into the battery metals market. And we've actually seen nickel prices first double, and then having doubled, nickel markets have effectively broken, much trading in nickel has simply shut down globally. So the disruption to commodity markets has been enormous. It's far from clear that there are short or even medium-term alternatives to Russian suppliers for many of these markets. And we think that we are going to have to grapple with tight and challenged and elevated commodity markets for some time. But the stress has gone beyond just the pricing, because whole supply chains have started to break down in many of these important commodities. And rebuilding those supply chains is going to be a time-consuming and complicated and disruptive process.
Thanks, Nick. And those really are staggering numbers you mentioned. Staying with the topic of the energy transition, what are the longer term implications of all this for global efforts to combat climate change?
So there's probably two sides to that coin. We've got to tackle that with on the one hand, but also on the other type of answer. So on the one hand, higher fossil fuel prices, all other things being equal, raise the economic competitiveness of what would otherwise be more expensive, lower carbon choices. For a consumer, buying an electric car looks like a much more compelling choice when the oil price is $110 a barrel from when the oil price is $30 a barrel. So that is going to be, in our view, a driver of consumer demand towards lower carbon alternatives. Unfortunately, though, there is an on the other hand, and that other hand is that higher commodity prices, particularly dramatically higher commodity prices, are going to make it much, much more expensive for consumers and reduce the available pool of surplus income and capital to devote to the energy transition. And our concern is that of those two factors, the negative factor is probably a stronger driver. And we're already starting to see some signs that policymakers are thinking about backing away from commitments and some signs of backward progress. We think it's notable that one of the biggest underperforming commodity markets since this crisis started is unfortunately European carbon markets, where we've seen European carbon price trade off by about 25%. So we think there are some positives from higher fossil fuel prices, but in general, what we want to see to drive the energy transition forward, it is a sort of Goldilocks environment for fossil fuel pricing. Not too high that it raises consumer stresses, but also not too low that it underprices carbon. We've shot way through those levels, and we think there is going to be some significant challenges for policymakers ahead as they seek to balance up the short-term squeeze on consumers versus those long-term policy objectives. And we know the longer the delay in putting into effect the energy transition, the greater the cost and the more challenging it's going to be.
Well, thanks, Nick, for that perspective and warning. there. Raza, let's turn to your asset class now. How has the conflict impacted emerging market credit?
Thank you, Max, and greetings to everyone. EM credit has obviously been in the eye of the storm since the start of the Russia-Ukraine situation. To give you a sense of the magnitude of the moves, both EM sovereigns and corporates have widened approximately 100 basis points since the conflict began. Barring one episode, current spread levels are the widest since the global financial crisis. Now, looking at the dynamics of the widening that we've seen, at an overall level, it's been led by high yield credits, which in sovereigns are about 170 basis points wider since the start of the invasion. Investment grade credits have also widened, but by a relatively smaller amount, you know, around 60 basis points. Regionally, the credits which are in close geographic proximity to the crisis have weakened the most. So places like Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan. And that's despite relatively decent economic fundamentals. Similarly, countries like Egypt and Pakistan, which are heavily dependent on fuel and energy imports and food imports, have seen sharp falls in bond prices. The underperformers also include countries where the reform stories are weak, fundamentals are weak, either because you have very large external financing needs, which are themselves reflection of very big current account and budget deficits. Now, the relative outperformers include obviously the commodity names in Middle East, Africa, and parts of Latin America. So the GCC countries, South Africa, Brazil have done well because external sectors will benefit from higher commodity prices. Now, with all this, what does all this widening of spread means is that the yield on our sovereign benchmark index is now over 7%. Which means approximately 60 basis points of carry alone on a monthly basis. Now, much of the long end in the high yield space is now over 10%, which means markets are effectively closed to them. And as a result, issuance has come to a standstill since the start of the conflict.
Thanks, Raza. Well, I'll jump in here with an obvious follow-up question, which is, in light of these dynamics, how is our active EMD team positioning?
So at the moment, we have several diverse, uncorrelated themes running in our portfolios. Obviously, to start off with, we like bonds, which benefit from higher commodity prices, and that's your Middle Eastern producers, your producers in Africa and in Latin and parts of Latin America. We also like countries where there is reform momentum or have very strong reform anchors in place, like an IMF program or a reform-minded government. These commodity producers and reformers also therefore benefit from rating improvements. So several of the countries that we've been invested in have seen rating upgrades in recent months. In addition, we also like curves which have potential for buybacks or liability management exercises, which helps lower their beta to market moves. Then there are credits which are defensive in nature and help to serve as anchors of our portfolios. Now, this defensive nature of these credits is largely a reflection of technicals, like a smaller float, there's local participation from investors, and they're tightly held bonds offshore. And finally, we like names where market dynamics have led to a widening in valuations, but we're not hugely concerned about their fundamentals, given the fact that they have decent external liquidity, they have lower debt burdens, they have favorable growth dynamics, and much more importantly, a proven ability to weather exogenous shocks.
Thanks, Raza. So a mixed picture with a lot going on under the headline index levels. Well, let's move now to index strategies, an area about which we've received a lot of questions. Howie, we've seen a series of announcements from index providers like FTSE, MSCI and S&P regarding Russian securities. Can you walk us through the latest decisions?
Yes, of course, Max. And just continuing on from the call from last week, I think it's probably helpful to recognize the pace at which the markets have moved and responded, you know, with the sanctions having come in last Monday and where we've got to as of yesterday. It's actually been a pretty unprecedented pace in which the asset management industry, as well as the index providers, have worked towards. Now, we've been actively engaging here at Elgin with index providers and custodians and depositories. And the central message from us here has been for index providers to act quickly and to communicate their positions on an accelerated timetable, given the pace and the escalation of the issue. Now, let's break it down into the three different asset classes: equities, fixed income, and I'll comment as well on the commodities. On the equity side, all major index providers that we certainly work with, MSCI, FTSE, Solactive, Scientific Beta, S&P, research affiliates, have all confirmed that Russian equities will be removed or have been removed from their indices. And they started doing that, FTSE, last Friday. We saw a couple earlier in the first half of the week, and actually finally with MSCI, as well as Solactive, having removed Russia as of yesterday's close as well. So all of those equity indices will no longer have Russia in their weighting. And all of those, as we had requested and submitted our proposals, they were removed at a price of zero to reflect the valuations in the market. Taking a look at the fixed income side of things, JP Morgan, as the leading kind of emerging markets benchmark, a slightly more nuanced story there, but they also have come very clear in the message that Russian bonds will be removed from all of their indices as at the end of this month. So the 31st of March rebalance, we will see Russian securities exit those indices as well. But taking a look at where we are on, let's say, the local currency emerging market indices, the weights of those indices perhaps a couple weeks ago were a bit higher, but now you know, they are being priced as of yesterday pretty much close to zero. And we expect that to remain the case given the lack of liquidity in the market to remain at around zero as it exits the index by the end of this month. Now, hard currency, we continue to obviously see some pricing throughout. However, it's been pretty one-sided, and the bids that do come through probably lack the depth that's required for this market. You know, there is some minor weights in there, currently less than 50 basis points. But again, that will be exiting the indices at the end of this month. On the emerging market corporate bond side, Russia also had a small weight on there, you know, prior to all these events, and we will also see that exit, you know, from the index as well at the end of this month. Currently, less than a percentage point there as well. Now, the implications on the fixed income side, what does that mean? Of course, when Russia leaves, let's say on the local currency side, that means there's going to be certain weights in countries and emerging markets where we're going to see more weighting towards China, Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, and Mexico. That's a natural consequence of Russia's downweight throughout the course of this month. Now, finally, I'll probably end on the commodity piece there, given Sonia's and of course Nick's comments there around commodities. Certainly a lot of focus there and volatility in certain classes. Now, we're talking about here a broad commodity complex, mainly the main reference point being Bloomberg Commodities. That continues to trade smoothly. Now, you know, of course, we talked about nickel having an effect in the market there, but that's a small proportion of a broad commodities index. So those indices continued unchanged, and actually the markets behind it continue to trade very clearly.
Well, thank you for that very comprehensive overview, Howie, and that's the index providers and indices. What are we doing within Elgin's own index strategies in light of the situation?
Yeah, sure, Max. You know, from Elgin's perspective, our emerging market funds continue to be open for trading. Liquidity of these funds have been a very key focus for us to manage that. You know, throughout the course of the past week and a half, we've looked at how these securities are valued, considered, and implementing our fair value policy here within LGIM, and also considering the spreads to reflect what's happening in the market as well. So as it sits right now, of course, these securities are not trading on the equity side, have come out of the index, but of course in funds, in emerging market funds, they remain in the portfolios. They are valued at zero for the time being. And at some point, of course, we can't judge exactly when that time is, but when they become liquid again and have some pricing, their values will be reflected in the net asset value of these funds. But of course, they remain out of the index, and the index providers have been pretty clear that when liquidity resumes, Russia will not automatically returning to the indices. They will join the queue again to be reviewed as an eligible country for emerging markets. But for the time being, they remain in portfolios at zero as it relates to equities. On the fixed income side, as we mentioned earlier, they don't come out of the indices until the 31st of March. Where there's liquidity, we will look at opportunities to see if there are ability to sell some of this down. The likelihood is that they remain in portfolios in the same way, likely to be valued near zero or at zero. And for us, that will stay in the portfolios until a market returns for them to be capable of exiting. And just finishing on that, on the commodity side, those continue to trade as well. We do have a number of commodity funds, and we've seen a lot of attention in the commodities market. And of course, the broad commodities indices continues to see performance go upwards, mainly because, again, the increase in the energy complex and as well as certain other commodities within the Bloomberg Commodity Index.
Thanks for that, Howie. Sonia, we've dug into some of the implications for energy, EMD and index strategies today, as well as the macro/policy outlook. Is there anything you'd like to add before we finish up?
Yes, thank you, Max. And I think what I would like to do is just trying to connect it all, because there is an awful lot going on that investors will need to consider when thinking about the way forward. And this is first and foremost what Howie just said. There have been a lot of technical adjustments, right, to adjust for the conflict in the region. But there will be longer term implications. And this is why, obviously, we had the focus on energy, because that will be the most profound adjustment processes that investors need to grapple with. These implications have definitely increased the recession risk in Europe. And we have to be aware that this is a big shift away from where we started the year. And because of the dependency, as Nick has outlined, and clearly the real, we have heard the terminology energy crisis and cost of living crisis, this will have a real impact on consumers, and we have not even seen the potential impact on consumer confidence. So this is something we will continue to analyze. As you know, we're not trying to predict the outcome of a geopolitical conflict. We can't. We can try and assess what potential outcomes might look like, but it's mostly preparing and understanding the longer term shifts that we know already will be underway. And I think Nick has very clearly outlined what European governments in particular will have to do and take away in order to understand how they can adjust their energy policy and energy mix in order to comply with the Paris Agreement and to reduce dependency. These are big long-term projects. These are big shifts that will have to be accomplished. But it is something that investors need to understand in order to understand where investment opportunities might arise on the back of this. We can definitely try and understand and have a look at the implications on globalization. Or as somebody told me the other day, we're probably now in a slowbalization world. Because again, this is not new. We have seen a plateau in globalization, but clearly already within the pandemic, we've had a first taster on what it means if we disrupt global supply chains. And clearly, if anything, the conflict might mean that we will see more of this. So companies will have to reassess the stability of their supply chains. They might have to reassess where they produce, because clearly the risk premium on specific countries will go up. And that brings me to the last point around responsible investing, ESG, and what this conflict means to this. Let me start with one topic that has been in the media quite frequently now, is around defense companies. We have seen a historic turnaround of the German government to prop up defense spending, which, given the German context, clearly has to be seen as historic. And even more historic, you have 72% of Germans in support of this move. That means we have to understand that individuals will look at safety and security differently, and the perception of the current security setup will be perceived differently. And we have to make sure that we can accommodate this and incorporate this in our framework. The other one is obviously how we judge countries in their ESG standards and setups. And again, I think the industry will have to make sure that everything we're discussing now is clear, transparent, and can be applied to all countries. Again, very important. LGIM, alongside a lot of the other asset managers, obviously has said we will not add to any positions in Russia and Belarus in particular, as Howie just said, that currently is not even really possible. But that's a fundamental stance that we have put out there until we have a clearer framework and understanding. So I think that just outlines the big goalposts that are moving that will influence investment markets to a large extent. But first and foremost, and more near term, is the rising and recession risk that we clearly need to understand and how policymakers can potentially balance this. So volatility will be with us. Reassessing risk is very important. But as Raza has said, a lot probably has been priced in already. So it's not about now selling everything, but understanding and potentially reallocating based on the changing environment we're currently operating in.
That's a really important point on which to end our call today. Thank you, Sonia, Howie, Nick and Raza, for your time, and watch out for more updates and analysis from us over the coming days and weeks.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording, and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties, and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions, and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and general investment management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website, elgim.com. Copyright 2021, Legal and General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, a licensed corporation, BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.